I'm Jim Fleming. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Future Perfect, Dreamers, Schemers, and Visionaries, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. This time, our peace of mind. Happiness is the salt of the universe. Without it, life is bland and hard to enjoy. But where can we find happiness and peace of mind? This hour, we'll take you to the cutting edge of happiness science and introduce you to visionaries who found a piece of the happiness puzzle, like Jill Bolte Taylor, who found joy in the devastation of a stroke.
I did feel this incredible sense of euphoria. I lost the boundaries of my body, the cells in my brain that understood where I begin and where I end. So I felt that I was as big as the universe.
And spiritual ecologist Satish Kumar on keeping your balance in the tangled world.
My life is not about success. My life is about self-realization and fulfillment. And if we seek fulfillment, we will have no stress. If we seek success, we will have stress.
And neuroscientist Richard Davidson demystifies peace, happiness, and life satisfaction.
Characteristics like happiness should best be regarded as skills which can be trained. And they're no different than learning a musical instrument or learning to play tennis.
Harvard-trained brain scientist Jill Bolte Taylor found an unexpected shortcut to inner peace, a path most of us would prefer not to take. In her memoir, My Stroke of Insight, Taylor tells the story of the unexpected stroke that wiped out part of her brain's left hemisphere, the weird euphoria that resulted, and the long and arduous process of recovery. Anne Strainchamps asked Jill Bolte Taylor to describe what happened on December 10th, 1996.
On the morning of the stroke, I woke up, and the first thing I really realized was that I had this pulsing pain behind my left eye. I'd never had a stroke before, of course. I'd never had a hemorrhage, so I didn't automatically assume the worst. And I just got up and went into my exercise room, and I thought, you know, getting my body moving again, getting the blood dissipating through my brain would be a good thing. So I jumped onto my CardioGlider, and I was exercising on this thing, realizing that as I looked down at my hands, they looked like primitive claws grasping onto this bar.
How long did it take before you realized you were having a stroke?
It was probably 45 minutes to an hour, and it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed. And that, to me, was the warning sign of stroke. Everything else was just peculiar, weird neurological stuff.
Did you ever begin to feel that you were dying?
I did. I on the morning of the stroke, after my colleague came and gave me help and took me to the first hospital, and the first hospital ran a CAT scan on my brain, and it showed this major hemorrhage in the left hemisphere. And then they shipped me by ambulance across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And at that point, I just really didn't have any energy left in my body, and I curled up into a little fetal ball. And the best way for me to describe it is I felt my energy shift. I felt my whole body become lighter. I surrendered, if you will. And I knew that I was no longer the one choreographing my life, and either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was going to be the moment of my death. And I have to say that it was, you know, you hear about these stories about it's an extremely peaceful experience. Well, for me, it was a total experience of euphoria. Mm-hmm. So I essentially found a space of nirvana.
Was it a disappointment to begin to come back?
It wasn't a disappointment, but it was definitely a process. And for me, it was a decision because I did feel this incredible sense of euphoria. I lost the boundaries of my body, the cells in my brain that understood where I begin and where I end, which made that definition, were no longer functioning. So I felt that I was as big as the universe. And it was a state of being. It was this incredible experience. At the same time, I was still alive. My body had been stabilized. I was given another opportunity to live life. And so it was a conscious choice for me. So I can't say that it was disappointing, but I can tell you that when my time comes again, there will be no fear, and there will be probably an elation and celebration. So, you know, I just feel totally grateful for the time that I have on this planet. And when it's done, you know, I had a wild ride. What a way to go.
You lost so much from the stroke. You gained a lot, too, though. When the left hemisphere shut down, you suddenly were able to access all of the ways of perceiving that belong to the right hemisphere. Can you describe some of what that was like?
Yeah, it was really wonderful. You know, we have these two very different hemispheres inside of our heads, and they process information in totally different ways. And the right hemisphere thinks in pictures, and it is all about the present moment. It is analyzing and perceiving all the information from our sensory systems in this moment and creating a big, enormous collage of this present moment. And the existence of the present moment is beautiful. There's no judgment there. It's just it is. And when I lost the judgment and the critical analysis ability of my left hemisphere in that language structure and the ability to think linearly and sequentially and methodically and to make sense of the past and to project ideas into the future, I lost the past. I lost the future. I was given the present moment. And for me, it was a total experience of peacefulness and euphoria. And for me, so much of my motivation to recover and to reconnect with the external world is to help people recognize that they have this experience of deep inner peace right there in the right hemisphere. It's always there. If you allow the left hemisphere verbiage system to shut down enough to allow you to come back to the present moment.
You know, the experience you describe, I think a great many of us would give a lot to experience it, but you know, it's kind of depressing to think that one of the few paths is through brain damage. So, and the other paths, you know, Buddhist meditation or yoga or some of the other more traditional paths, they are very time consuming. Have you figured out through your own experiences any faster ways to shut down the left hemisphere for a while?
Yeah, I think that it's very important that we recognize that both hemispheres are always functioning. And I kind of I don't know who it was, someone famous said that, you know, the blue sky is always there. And to me, the blue sky is the consciousness of the right hemisphere. And then the clouds come in, which is the consciousness of the left hemisphere and the verbiage, and it blocks our ability to see the blue sky. But the blue sky is still always there. And to me, that's what's going on with our consciousnesses. We always have that blue sky. That right hemisphere experience of euphoria is at the essence of what we are. So I encourage people to pay attention to the two very distinctively different characters inside of your body. You always have the option, moment by moment, of saying, in this moment, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to look at the world around me. I'm going to escape all the things that I'm thinking about. And I'm just going to pay attention to how the air feels, the temperature of the air, my breath, pay attention to feeling it come in and go out, look at the colors in the field around me, stop thinking and analyzing everything that's going on inside of your left hemisphere, all the jargon. And when you allow yourself to recognize when you're already in your right hemisphere and having that right hemisphere experience, then you can consciously choose to have that experience at any moment.
You make it sound so easy, but I don't think it's that easy.
You have to be persistent, you know, and I think that what I bring to this this story that hasn't been brought before is through the eyes of a scientist who specializes in the brain, we do have two very separate hemispheres. And I think it's a matter of recognizing that we are biologically designed to have this experience of feeling at one with all that is. And to be able to say, oh, all I'm doing is quieting a certain group of cells inside of my brain, and you can train yourself to do that just like you can train yourself to do anything.
Jill Bolte Taylor talking with Anne Strangechamps about her book, My Stroke of Insight. Taylor is a neuroanatomist at the Indiana University Medical School. If happiness is a skill, then how do we learn it? For answers, University of Wisconsin neuroscientist Richard Davidson turned to some of the world's oldest spiritual traditions. Davidson made headlines when he invited contemplatives, most notably the Dalai Lama, to meditate inside a brain scanner. And then he discovered that he could, literally, see the results of meditation. He told Steve Paulson he became interested in the benefits of meditation early on in his career, when he was still a grad student.
I had the great fortune of being around some people as a graduate student whose personal demeanor just was really attractive to me. They seemed incredibly happy. They also seemed very generous. They seemed to be people who are very compassionate, who are very kind. They were just people who I felt really wonderful with. And one of the things I learned is that these were people who had been meditating for quite some time.
So did you start meditating yourself?
I did. I first went to India in 1974 to the consternation of a large segment of the Harvard psychology faculty who thought I was going off the deep end. But that was my first taste of intensive meditation practice. So during the time I was in India, we're meditating for more than 12 hours a day in silence, very rigorously.
Did that change you, that experience?
Yes, it definitely changed me.
How so?
It gave me an insight into the power that this kind of practice can have in transforming the mind. I got a glimpse that it was possible using the equipment that we come into the world with and nothing more to engage in mental exercises that really can improve one's well-being.
Let me ask you about your brain imaging studies of Buddhist monks, because you have worked with the Dalai Lama, who's encouraged some Tibetan Buddhists, who very experienced monks, to come to your lab in Wisconsin to go through your brain scans. First of all, who were these people who came to Madison?
They're an extraordinary collection of individuals. Each of them has been practicing for a minimum of 10,000 hours over the course of their lifetime. And in addition, each of them has done at least one three-year retreat, practicing every single day, 365 days a year, for a minimum of 8 hours a day for three continuous years.
What happened when you hooked them up to your brain scans? What did they do?
Well, there are a number of things that we've already reported in the scientific literature. Some of them we think are quite dramatic. One of the very first paper that we published several years ago showed that when we record the brain electrical signals, when practitioners enter a meditation period in the laboratory, there is just a dramatic and visually detectable change. That's very unusual. In other studies, we have used functional magnetic resonance imaging to probe the detailed circuits in the brain that are affected by different kinds of meditation. And we've been particularly interested in how the generation of compassion affects the brain's response to emotional stimuli that we present. In some sense, you can think of this as the equivalent to a cardiac stress test for the brain.
Are you talking about things like, I don't know, making a loud noise while someone's in the middle of meditation?
A blood-curdling scream. I mean, really loud. That would be, you know, jolting.
Uh-huh. And how do these people react?
To paraphrase one of the practitioners, he said the scream sounded like the equivalent of if you were in a sunlit room, you know, that had windows on all sides, it was very brightly lit, and you lit a candle in the room, you would notice the candle, but it wouldn't stand out.
So, I mean, obviously, these Buddhist meditators are extraordinarily gifted at being able to control some of these mental functions. Have they rewired their brains in a way that's just totally unlike the brains of most of us mere mortals?
I believe that when we ultimately learn more, we will find out that they have rewired their brain in interesting ways. But I think that it's important to view the changes that they produce as being entirely accessible to all of us. One of the questions which were frequently asked when I present this work to lay people in particular is they say, well, you know, this is all very interesting, but we're not going to, you know, in this lifetime and probably, you know, in any lifetime, we're not going to be meditating for 10,000 hours. And so we recently did a study where we had novice practitioners who had never meditated before, but who were interested in learning. We had them engage in practice for 30 minutes a day for 2 weeks. That's it. And what we found briefly is that just 2 weeks of practice, 30 minutes a day, actually makes a difference that is detectable in the brain.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Buddhist meditators that you studied, did they seem like basically happy people? I mean, not just when they were meditating, but other times?
Enormously. I mean, just enormously, infectiously. This is one of the reasons why it's just so cool to be around them. Hmm. I actually, this is, you know, just a complete anecdote, but nevertheless, I think it's symptomatic. We had one of our monks who came to our laboratory. They were staying at a local hotel. And the day after this monk left, I received a phone call in my office from the manager of this hotel. And he said, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt your day, but I just wanted to call to express my thanks for having such a wonderful, interesting person stay at our hotel. There are three people, he said, that spontaneously remarked on how wonderful it was to interact with this person. And he just wanted to encourage me to send him other people.
Send more Buddhist meditators
exactly.
Over to the hotel.
Now, this has never happened before or since.
So getting back to the question of happiness, do you think what these, for instance, these experienced Buddhist meditators are doing, sort of their pursuit of happiness, is that sort of fundamentally the same as what most of us would think of as happiness?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of good research today which indicates that for the average American citizen, her or his idea about what will make them happy is flawed. That is, we are not good at predicting or at forecasting what will make us happy.
Give me an example of that.
Buying a fancy new car, getting the bigger and better of this or that. One of the things the Buddhists have learned is to be better forecasters of what will make them happy. And so they have realized that these material possessions, they may make a transient difference, but they're not going to produce a sustained difference. There have even been studies of lottery winners, you know, people who are blue-collar workers who suddenly find themselves with $30 million. And what you see from those studies is that there's an initial boost in their happiness, and then, you know, it goes right back down to baseline. And so one of the great insights from the contemplative traditions, not just Buddhism, is that generosity, actually practicing generosity, actually is something that can produce more sustained increases in happiness. And there was a paper that was recently published in Science by a group of investigators in Canada, where they one component of this research involved giving a group of people, they come in at the beginning of the day, they're given a sum of money, like $50, and they're told, spend it on yourself. This is just a gift. Buy yourself whatever you'd like for this amount of money. And they took another group of people, gave them the same amount of money, and said, your job is to spend the money on other people. Just buy things that you think other people need and give it to them. And lo and behold, when you spend money on other people, you're a lot happier than when you spend money on yourself. Hmm. So I think there's an important insight there.
Let me go back then to sort of the question about sort of ordinary people then. I mean, what do you take away from these studies in terms of what, I mean, do you have suggestions that people might do? I mean, I guess other than the obvious of we should all spend some time meditating every day.
I do have some suggestions. I mean, the one is that, and I think that one can start with really short amounts of practice. You know, people often say, well, I can't, you know, I just, my mind is such that I just can't meditate, or I can't sit for more than 5 minutes. And if someone says that, well, just sit for 5 minutes then. I think there are other things that can be done too, but they need to be explored.
Richard Davidson is a neuropsychologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a longtime friend of the Dalai Lama. Time magazine named him one of the world's 100 most influential people.
Happiness is finding a pencil.
Pizza with sausage.
Telling the time.
Happiness is learning to whistle.
Tying your shoe for the very first time.
Coming up, if learning to meditate isn't your path to greater happiness, what else can you do? A report from the front lines of new happiness research, next. And what do you think is the secret to happiness? That's a question philosophers have been debating for centuries.
Seneca, the great Roman statesman, perhaps because he suffered greatly in his life, believed that the key to happiness was entirely inside your mind. Seneca said that the only thing we can control is our attitude toward the events in life. Just as the sailor cannot control the force or the direction of the wind, we cannot control the events that surround us in life. But what we can control is how we react to them. And that reaction is the secret to happiness.
I'm Jim Fleming. This is Future Perfect, Dreamers, Schemers, and Visionaries, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge and from PRI, Public Radio International. A decade ago, you could count the number of happiness researchers on the fingers of one hand. Today, scientific research into happiness and well-being is a veritable industry. There's a psychology, a sociology, even an economics of happiness. What have we learned?
There's no secret to happiness. It's just it involves a long-term commitment and effort. And it's very similar to fitness and weight loss. So if you need to lose weight, you don't just go on a diet for 3 weeks. You know, and then you're done. You know, you probably have to diet for the rest of your life. And if you're born with what's called a happiness set point, with a baseline for happiness that's low, you need to really put a lot of effort, change your habits. It's really a lifelong endeavor.
Sonia Lubomirsky is a psychologist at the University of California, Riverside. She's winning prizes for her research on how very specific happiness-boosting strategies work. For example, one of the problems she spends a lot of time thinking about these days is a phenomenon psychologists call hedonic adaptation.
You buy a new car or a new couch. At first, you know, you notice it, like, oh, every time you get into the new car, you think, oh, this is so fun to drive. The moment you kind of stop noticing the new car and you just kind of use it in a mechanical way, you've adapted to it. So what I argue is that hedonic adaptation to positive experiences is one of the largest obstacles to happiness.
In her lab, Lubomirsky tests ways to combat hedonic adaptation, many of which sound like things your mom probably told you. Pay attention, count your blessings, cultivate gratitude. Well, it turns out mom was right.
All of these happiness strategies increase the frequency of positive emotions. You know, people feel joyful or curious, interested, affectionate. There's a theory in positive psychology that argues that positive emotions serve as an antidote to negative emotions. They basically help neutralize negative emotions. So with gratitude, for example, you know, you can't really feel grateful and at the same time feel greedy or envious or bitter.
Now, one of my big questions about all the new happiness research is whether it isn't just a little self-indulgent. Compared to other countries, Americans are preoccupied to the point of obsession with happiness. I mean, not only is it enshrined in our Declaration of Independence, at least one survey shows Americans think about happiness, on average, once a day. But Lubomirsky says new research is uncovering some surprising benefits to happiness.
Being happy is not just something that feels good. It's not just sort of a hedonistic thing. But happier people are more successful across a wide variety of domains in their life. Happier people are more creative, they're better leaders, they're more sociable, they're more likely to have fulfilling relationships, they're healthier, They have stronger immune systems. They're more philanthropic. They're less self-centered, actually more other-centered. And so I think that a focus on happiness is not necessarily a bad thing. I think people who are happier might actually be good for the world at large.
Another new direction in happiness research is to go global.
I've been to Greenland, where I worked with Inuit seal hunters. I've worked with tribal Maasai in Kenya. I've worked with prostitutes in Calcutta, with peace activists in Palestine, landmine victims in Cambodia.
Robert Biswas Diener was born to study happiness. His father, Ed Diener, pioneered the study of positive emotions. When, as a young psychology student, Biswas Diener, as he puts it, drank the Kool-Aid and saw the magic of happiness studies, he decided to find out whether happiness is the same for everyone.
If you ask people all over the world, whether it's in Brazil or China or the United States, do you value happiness? People resoundingly say yes. But they do define the experience of happiness a little bit differently. If you look at the Confucian Eastern Rim countries, primarily in Southeast Asia, for example, what they strive for, what they think is an ideal emotion, are things like peace, connectedness, harmony. Whereas, by contrast, in the United States or other Western individualistic countries, we also like positive emotion, but we like it to be a little bit higher arousal. We like enthusiasm, excitement, intense joy.
Biswas Diener is sometimes called the Indiana Jones of positive psychology because he isn't afraid to put his body on the line in the service of happiness research. On one trip to survey the Maasai in Africa, he was having trouble getting anyone to participate in his research. He realized he had to do something to prove himself to the village elders.
I asked them to burn me, much like they burn their own arms and legs, just as a sort of a show of toughness. I asked them to take a hot stick and brand my chest. So I went out into the bush with a group of young warriors, and they started a fire, and they got a stick glowing hot, and they were about to press it into my chest. I took off my shirt, and my translator leaned over just before and said to me, "Oh, Robert, I forgot to tell you, you can't even move a muscle or you'll be branded a coward. You must be completely stone-faced." And so I steeled myself, and they pressed this glowing hot stick into my chest. And to my great shame, I will admit both to raising one eyebrow and clenching my jaw. I think they must have been, you know, kind of generous of spirit to me because they didn't seem to think that was overly cowardly. And my translator said, "Wow, you did really well, Robert. Now there's only 8 more to go."
The good news is he got 100% participation in his happiness surveys after that. And he found that the Maasai are, by and large, pretty happy. But then, so are most of the people he's surveyed, from the Inuit whale hunters to the Calcutta slum dwellers.
The take-home message overall is that, by and large, most people are pretty happy most of the time.
Economics used to be called the dismal science. But even economists are getting happy these days. In Britain, Richard Layard is one of the founders of what's known as happiness economics, the idea that economic policy should be designed to produce national well-being, which, Layard says, is what the 18th century founders of economics originally intended.
What unfortunately happened in the 20th century is that people lost faith in happiness as something which we could usefully discuss. But the result was we thought the best thing to do was just to measure the amount of stuff which was being produced. And that's how we got diverted from the pursuit of happiness, which was the Enlightenment goal, to the pursuit of GDP, which was really a betrayal of that ideal.
Layard is part of an international movement pushing for a new measure of economic well-being, GNH, or Gross National Happiness. Pioneered by the tiny Himalayan nation of Bhutan, the GNH movement is dedicated to the proposition that a government's job is to promote not just the wealth, but the happiness of its people. What would it look like in practice? Scandinavia.
The happiest societies that we know from all the surveys are the Scandinavian societies, in which there's more emphasis put on trusting relationships between people and mutual respect than there is, for example, in your country or mine.
It's not just that Scandinavians are nicer people than we are. It's that they have higher levels of trust in each other and in their government. For instance, Layard says, asked whether they think most other people can be trusted in Scandinavia.
Well over 60% of people say yes. In Britain and America, this is now down to 30%, and it used to be 60%. So we've had a big fall in trust in our societies, which I think reflects a growth of excessive individualism. And here's a practical example. The Reader's Digest left wallets with addresses in them in streets in many large cities. In Stockholm, every wallet was returned, which was not the case in London or New York. So there's something real there about the extent to which people feel involved in the fates of other people.
I don't know about you, but I find it both ironic and somehow comforting that in several thousand years, the best piece of advice we've come up with is still the golden rule. Do unto others as you'd have done unto you. Or if you really want to increase your pleasure in life, go make someone else happy. We heard from economist Richard Layard and psychologists Robert Biswas-Diener and Sonia Lubomirsky. For more information on their work and recent books, visit our website at ttbook.org.
The great 11th century Islamic mystic, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, believed that imagination was the key to happiness. We might find this a very surprising way to think about happiness, heirs as we are to a scientific tradition and key believers in 12-step programs, but Ghazali thought that happiness was really about imagining the kind of person you wanted to become and then striving in your life to actually become that person. Happiness means being a visionary about your own life.
More secrets of happiness from the past coming up. First, though, Satish Kumar is a modern mystic with his feet firmly on the ground. The former Jain monk and follower of Gandhi once walked over 8,000 miles to advocate for nuclear disarmament. Today, he's the founder of the eco-spiritual magazine Resurgence and the author of a recent book called The Buddha and the Terrorist. As a spokesperson for the International Green Movement, Kumar's schedule is a whirlwind. Despite that, he's found peace of mind by leading what he calls a stress-free life. He told Steve Paulson that his secret is to take life at a walking pace.
Spirituality and speed don't go together. The very fact that you are walking, you have to go slowly, and you have to believe that when God made time, he made plenty of it. There is no shortage of time. You don't have to get somewhere quickly. Getting somewhere is not as important as how you get there. So the process of living, the process of walking is more important. This is why I called my autobiography No Destination. Because when you are obsessed with reaching somewhere, you take any means of travel. But when journey itself becomes important, then you realize that not only this walking where you are going somewhere, the life itself is a journey.
Well, I have to ask you about this because you're not a monk anymore. You live in England. You edit a magazine. You teach at a college. You give talks around the world. It sounds like it could be very demanding. I'm wondering how much you can incorporate these principles of slowness and walking and not venturing too far off, how much that you can incorporate into your own life.
All those things I do slowly. And I get up in the morning and I spend an hour reading spiritual scripts. I spend at least half an hour, 40 minutes doing yoga and meditation every day. And then I, at least half an hour, I have a siesta after lunch. So whatever work I am doing, editing a magazine or lecturing or whatever other work I'm doing, I never hurry. I say there's plenty of time. The quality of your work is more important than the speed of your work and the quantity of your work. So I always shift my consciousness from quantity to quality.
Do you end up saying no a lot? I mean, when people ask you to do things?
Yes, to some extent, I have to say no, because if somebody's asking me to go to a conference and I'm already doing something else in my diary, then I will have to say no. But I try to say yes as much as I can, because I like to honor people's requests and people's invitation. So I do it with a very light sort of foot. I don't feel any kind of stress or strain when I do something. I do slowly, and I do with love and with care, and that way I can live simple and slow life.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how you manage to do this when I can't and so many other people can't. I mean, for me, it seems to be this test to see if I can fit everything that I seem to need to do into a day.
No, I do only one thing at a time. And when I'm doing that thing, I'm doing only that thing at that time. I'm not doing anything. I'm not thinking about anything else that I have to do too much, other things. I will do what I'm doing fully, totally present in that moment. And when I finish doing that, then whatever next comes, I will do that fully and totally at that moment. So I live in the moment, in the here and now. Every moment is a very beautiful moment. And my full concentration, full attention, full mindfulness is there. And that way, I don't feel any stress. I don't think that I have to do too much. I have a day, whole day. Time is always coming. I have plenty of time to come and plenty of time to do things. And if I don't accomplish everything in this life, there's a next life.
So are you really saying that you don't have any stress in your life?
No stress.
No stress at all?
No stress at all. Because if you are living in the moment, in the here and now, and everything you do is a work of spiritual practice and a work of art, then there is no stress. And you are painting a picture, you can't feel stress because this is what you want to do. If you are writing a piece of poem, you can't feel stress because this is what you want to do. So I do only what I want to do. And when I do it with imagination, with mindfulness, with slowness, and with creativity, with imagination, and with full presence, with mindfulness. And then there's no stress. Stress is because we are worried. Am I going to achieve? I'm not trying to achieve anything. There's nothing to achieve. Action in itself is its own reward.
But doesn't stress also come from just trying to do certain things, to take responsibility? You know, maybe you have a job for most of the day. You have children, and you have all kinds of responsibilities there. I'm just trying to think of how some of what you're talking about applies to the typical American lifestyle.
No, I do things without doing them. I'm not the doer. Things are happening through me, but I am not the doer. I don't take any burden of the action. Action is naturally flowing through me. So like children come through you, not from you, Khalil Gibran said. In the same way, actions come through you. Words come through you. I'm speaking to you now. These words are coming through me. I'm not taking any kind of ownership or possession or worry, or I'm not in any stress. I'm not in any hurry. I'm just speaking in a nice, relaxed way. So this way, I do every action, and there is no need to have any stress. I'm not interested in any outcome. I'm not interested in any achievement. I'm not trying to get somewhere. I'm not trying to succeed in my life. My life is not about success. My life is about self-realization and fulfillment. And if we seek fulfillment, we will have no stress. If we seek success, we will have stress.
Satish Kumar talking with Steve Paulson. Kumar was one of Gandhi's followers. Now in his 70s, he's the founder of Schumacher College in England and the editor of Resurgence magazine, which has been called the spiritual voice of the Green Movement. I'm Jim Fleming. This is Future Perfect, Dreamers, Schemers, and Visionaries, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge and from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. How to achieve happiness is one of those questions that keeps philosophers awake at night, has done for centuries, millennia even. So if you need a little happiness boost today, why reinvent the wheel? Why not see what the great minds of the past had to say on the subject? Richard Schock is a cultural historian at the University College of London. He recently published an indispensable little book called The Secrets of Happiness, 3,000 Years of Searching for the Good Life. Schock says the way we think about happiness today is a thin, watery version of what was once a deep and complex subject. What's changed?
I think what's changed is the sense that we are entitled to be happy. We have come to regard happiness as a sort of consumer product, the ultimate luxury item. And if only we just had enough money, we could go into the happiness store, plunk down our money and take it off the shelf and then take it home. And that's a very unusual, very modern way of thinking about happiness. Even Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence said our right is only to the pursuit of happiness. We do not have a right as such to be happy, but we think we do have a right to be happy. And our immediate way of thinking about that is pleasure. We have this fantasy idea that if only we could just cram our lives full of pleasure and rid our lives of every possible pain, then we would be happy. But you know, people have been thinking about happiness for as long as humanity has been thinking about anything, for thousands and thousands of years. And the people who have thought most profoundly about happiness, whether it's in philosophical traditions or in religious traditions, those thinkers have rarely identified happiness with pleasure. It's a peculiarly modern, individual, consumerist, if you will, notion of way of looking at the good life.
Do you think that the great pursuers of happiness would agree with you in this? Do Seneca and Ghazali, do Thomas Aquinas and the utilitarians all come at this in more or less the same way, even though they have different avenues that they use to pursue happiness?
That's a terrific question, which admits of no easy answer, so I'll do my best. The hardline Stoics, like Seneca, because they suffered so greatly in their life, had a really kind of refugee or escapist sense of happiness. They wanted to flee from the world and live entirely in their mind, to shield themselves from whatever was happening. So in such harsh, hard circumstances, you can imagine that someone might think that the secret of happiness really is to withdraw from the world.
We should look a little into the contrasting views. The Epicureans, for instance, the word itself now almost equates with pleasure, with personal pleasure, whereas Epicurus, as you note in The Secrets of Happiness, was not actually interested very much in his own personal pleasure.
It was just the reverse. You talk about words that have come to mean almost the opposite of what they meant originally. Epicurean is one of them. We think of people who are just gluttons, who can't get enough of sensual pleasure. But old Epicurus himself famously said to a friend, "Send me a morsel of cheese so that I can have a feast." And his view was that if you ratchet down your expectations for what you need in life, for the pleasures and the good things, if you can just curtail them, rein them in, you're actually going to be much happier because your threshold is much lower. So when those things do come along, you'll be really happy. If your threshold is very high and you're expecting one intense moment of pleasure after another, well, of course, you're going to end up disappointed because nobody has that kind of life. So to some extent, lowering, moderating your expectations is one of the keys to becoming happy.
And John Bentham of the utilitarian philosophy believed almost exactly the opposite, that it was that happiness was pleasure minus whatever pain you experience.
Exactly. He called it the philosophic calculus, the happiness equation. You add up all the pleasures in your life, and then you subtract all the pains in your life. And what's left over, if it's a positive number, is happiness. If it's a negative number, is unhappiness. If only it were that simple. But of course, the equation is impossible to effect in real life. And I think the sense that the equation doesn't work is yet another reminder that pleasures really cannot be the basis of happiness for a couple of reasons. And the most obvious one is that pleasures fade.
If Bentham and the utilitarians were to be applied to the life of Seneca, he would be an extremely unhappy man, wouldn't he?
He would, by those lights. But if you read what Seneca says about his own life, he found his strength from within. And I think that's something that a lot of us can connect to, even today, thousands of years later, in entirely different circumstances. We often feel that the world hits us, assaults us with negative forces, whether it's economic difficulties or people disappoint us, our plans don't go exactly as we expect. And we feel that to some extent the world is beyond our control. And all we can control, again, is our response to it, our attitude toward it. And usually that means a little bit of detachment, try to distance yourself from all those things. And in that detachment and that distance can come a calmness, a reflective period, a moment of meditation. Seneca would call it serenity or tranquility. That, in fact, is another name for happiness.
Tell me about another. Tell me about Ghazali. It seems to me that he is more of what we would call a mystic.
That's right. Ghazali was a Sufi mystic, not of the highest order, but he was very sympathetic to that movement. The Sufis were about imagination and personal experience. They thought that experience was really the high road to happiness. And for them, they defined it as an individual encounter with God. And imagination was the key because, of course, you're trying to get in touch with the transcendent, with the infinite, with the more, however you wish to define it. So it really has to come to you through imaginations, whether that's in Sufi poetry or music or the great Sufi dances of the whirling dervishes. All those things are attempts to remind us that happiness cannot be reduced to a kind of logical, linear, rational 12-step program or formula, anything like that. That becoming happy is really a kind of voyage, if you will, a way of being transported into the unknown. And that's why the mystics relied upon visions and poetry and dances to get them there, the sense of imagining what a different kind of life would be and then bringing that about within your life day to day. Again, I think that's a profound rebuke and challenge to the way we think about happiness as today. We want it all, as they say, done and dusted. We want our 12 steps, our rules, our 10 commandments of happiness. And we don't want to think of happiness as being something a bit more fugitive, a bit more elusive that requires imagination.
Richard Schock is a cultural historian at the University College of London. His book, Secrets of Happiness, is a short course in 3,000 years of thinking about the good life.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry. Be happy. In every life we have some trouble. When you worry, you make it double. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. Be happy now.
We're giving the last word in this hour to the great American soul singer Al Green, a man who spent his life testifying on stage and in the pulpit to the power of grace and love and, yes, happiness. Al Green's latest CD is an old-school R&B offering called Lay It Down. Green did an interview a while back with Steve Paulson. They talked about a lot of things. Here's what they had to say about happiness.
Nobody want to talk about I love you because that seems like it's too melancholy or something. But love is a strong, strong element. And if we can use that, we wouldn't hate so much.
So do you think love is still what makes the world go round?
Oh, love is what makes the world go round. See, I have got sunshine on a cloudy day. When it's cold outside, I got the month of May. I guess you'd say, well, make me feel, my girl, that's it, Temptations. That's it, you know, sugar pie, you know, Four Tops. I mean, that's what... Can't help myself, you know, I love you and nobody else. That's what it is, yeah.
Now, one of your classic songs from the 70s was your big hit, Love and Happiness.
Okay.
And it seems like happiness is another one of those words that's really not talked about a lot in contemporary music.
Yeah.
It sort of raises the question of whether happiness is something very different than love, or it's kind of like love, but just sort of said in a different way.
Well, you know the way we put it in there. We put love and happiness in there, right?
Uh-huh.
And that's the way we grew up, that the two go together. If you're going to be in love, you probably are going to be a happy man. And so we're thinking about love and happiness. Now, there's a lot of folks that say they're in love today, but they're awfully unhappy. And something is wrong with that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love.
So what makes you happy?
What makes me happy? To be able to be an artist, to paint a picture, and the people can understand the artwork in the picture. And my whole life has been kind of contributed to that. And the work in the tabernacle, and also out on the road. I mean, it all goes together because, you know, God works all things together for good for them that love Him. So, I mean, man, I'm pretty happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you sort of see sort of God being part of, I mean, obviously your work in your church, but also what you do when you're touring on the road.
Shoot, if he wasn't, look, God is not just God on Sunday or when I'm in the tabernacle. God is God on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. He's God every day. So I said I work all things. That means everything. Mm-hmm.
I just met you just the other day. Everything started flowing my way. Oh, yeah. I just love you. Really, I just love you for yourself. Mm. I don't want no. Nobody.
Al Green's latest album is called Lay It Down. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Our Peace of Mind, is part of the special series Future Perfect, Dreamers, Schemers, and Visionaries. The series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, visit our website. It's ttbook.org/visionaries.
PRI. Public Radio International.